Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, October the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the outrage continues over the president's abrupt decision to pull U.S. support out of Syria. As Democrats ramp up their impeachment inquiry, the White House decides it will not cooperate.
It's just a scam. This is a scam by the Democrats to try and win an election that they're not going to win in 2020.
Also ahead, classic rock band Eagles plan to perform their entire Hotel California album on a massive tour in 2020. It's all on today's International Edition. Protesters in northern Syria demonstrated Tuesday against U.S. troops pulling out of positions along the border with Turkey. They expressed concern the U.S. is essentially abandoning Kurdish fighters who fought alongside American forces in the years-long battle to defeat the Islamic State group. President Trump announced Sunday that U.S. troops will pull out as Turkey moves forward with a military offensive. Trump's decision has led to condemnations from Congress, clarification from the Pentagon, and fear from local allies. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports.
Turkish forces have reportedly launched strikes on northern Syria just hours after the U.S. agreed to get out of the way of its offensive.
We've been in Syria for many years. You know, Syria was supposed to be a short-term hit. Just a very short-term hit, and we were supposed to be in and out.
Kurdish allies, who were told the U.S. would be around to prevent Turkey from attacking, feel lied to.
The United States, as always, has betrayed us and sold us once again.
Kurdish forces have dismantled defenses in the north due to American assurances of protection. Locals now worry they'll suffer the same fate as other Syrians did in previous Turkish offensives.
People were killed, women were abducted, and a lot of people fled their homes. Turkey acted inhumanely there, and we fear that it will do the same here.
Democrats and Republicans have criticized the move. Senator Lindsey Graham tweeted, "By abandoning the Kurds, we have sent the most dangerous signal possible. America is an unreliable ally."
Mr. Trump seems to sometimes lose patience or attention in regard to sustaining the victory. And we've often had successes in the Middle East that we worked very hard to attain and then just didn't do enough to sustain it.
The Pentagon appears caught in the middle, stating today that the Department of Defense does not endorse a Turkish operation in northern Syria. Trump appeared to walk the decision back a bit, threatening sanctions to, quote, obliterate the Turkish economy should their forces do anything off limits.
I don't think we're in a great place to be trading threats with Turkey about how we're all going to retaliate against each other. It's much more important to try to work cooperatively on the ground, mitigate our differences.
And officials at the Pentagon worry that Islamic State, the common enemy of the Turks, Kurds, and Americans, could see the latest discord as an opportunity to resurge. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
And to talk more about the security, national security concerns, is VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Why is there all this concern? If you could just go into it a little deeper for us.
In some ways, it's what everybody saw play out back in December of last year when the president all of a sudden had a conversation with Turkey's Erdogan and then came out a little bit later on Twitter, said ISIS, is the Islamic State terror group, is defeated, and he was going to pull all U.S. troops home, a decision that slowly was walked back but did lead to the resignations of some key officials, including the then Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis. So there's a similar situation playing out here. The difference is that while it was just an announcement that the president made the first time around last December when he said he planned on pulling troops back, this time the orders actually went through that troops were going to be moved in this zone that is affected by a security mechanism agreed upon by the United States and Turkey to basically reassure Turkey. The idea of the security mechanism was to reassure Turkey that because Turkey has concerns about some of the U.S. partner forces on the ground, some of the Kurdish forces, the YPG, which have links to a terrorist group in Turkey, the PKK. And so this was meant to reassure Turkey, but at the same time to reassure the Kurdish forces under the umbrella of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, which has been really the lead ground force that helped roll back the Islamic State Caliphate. Now, after this conversation, the security mechanism is gone. And to many lawmakers, they see this as a betrayal of the most valuable ground force, the most valuable partner force on the ground. So there are a lot of concerns about what it's going to do to the situation on the ground. And there are lots of concerns, both by Democrats, Republicans, lawmakers that traditionally have opposed the president, lawmakers that have traditionally supported the president, about what message this is sending, not just to the Kurdish forces on the ground that have worked with the U.S., but also to other U.S. partners in the region and other potential U.S. partners, when it seems that in some ways the U.S. is abandoning a key ally.
It sounds pretty serious when you hear a Trump ally like former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley coming out and saying something pertaining to the fact of we will see dead Kurds. Is it all but certain that this would be a disaster for the Kurds if the U.S. pulled out and left them on their own while Turkey came in with an assault?
For a lot of onlookers, people like the former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, also the former U.S. envoy to the coalition to defeat the Islamic State, Brett McGurk, who worked both for the Obama administration and also for the Trump administration, for President Trump, have lambasted the president on social media, saying that beyond the betrayal, that there are very significant security concerns immediately on the ground, because they say if you look at all the intelligence that the U.S. has and has shared and has talked about publicly, this will give the Islamic State a chance to regroup. But it also, they are saying, gives other players in the region, including Iran, with which the U.S. has been ramping up sanctions and just putting on a pressure campaign to try to limit their influence in the region, in addition to their nuclear ambition, that gives them an opportunity to create more mischief, to expand their reach. They say it gives Russia a chance to expand its influence and to further prop up the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, which the U.S. and President Trump has criticized heavily for the way that Assad has treated his own people and bombed his own people and used chemical weapons against civilians. So there are all of a sudden a bunch of players that are going to be free or feel free to act. So the consequences are much more than just Turkey sending in forces and starting to attack forces they say are terrorists, but that have been working as U.S. allies in the fight against ISIS. So there's a lot going on here. There are a lot of potential consequences. There's been a lot of talk from the international community, from U.S. allies, pressuring Turkey publicly not to do anything.
What about the prisoners?
Well, that's a big question. The U.S. has said that the Kurdish forces have been holding about 11,000 captured Islamic State terror fighters. Of those, about 2,200 are foreign fighters, but they've been held in makeshift prison facilities, converted schools, hospitals across northeastern Syria. And so there are two concerns. First, the Kurds will be forced to move forces that are currently keeping those ISIS prisoners under guard and basically let them go as they defend themselves. The other concern is some of the displaced person camps, which the SDF has also been providing security for, that house about 73,000 ISIS relatives, family members, and other folks who are supportive of the caliphate. What happens when those people either go free or start being able to take advantage of lax security and perhaps break free? That's where a lot of the concern comes in terms of a big resurgence, an immediate resurgence of Islamic State in an area in which the caliphate have been completely rolled back.
All right. That is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Sullivan. Thank you for being with us. Opposition Democrats are moving ahead with their impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump, even as the administration blocks key witnesses from testifying and has been slow to provide documents. Eventually, Democrats may vote to impeach Trump over his dealings with Ukraine in the House of Representatives, where they have a majority. And that would lead to an impeachment trial in the Senate, where the president and his Republican supporters have a distinct advantage and, as of now, would likely vote to acquit him. VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone has more on the president's political firewall from Washington.
At the White House, President Trump remains defiant in the face of the Democratic impeachment inquiry.
What they did to this country is unthinkable. And it's lucky that I'm the president, because I guess, I don't know what, a lot of people said very few people could handle it. I sort of thrive on it. You know why? Because it's so important.
At the heart of the impeachment inquiry is Trump's effort to convince other nations to investigate a political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. Democrats see the president's actions as an abuse of power. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff.
This is one of the few impeachment inquiries in the history of our country. It goes to the core of whether the president abused his office to seek political help in his reelection campaign and did so to the detriment of our nation's security.
Trump has denied any wrongdoing and said his focus was fighting corruption, not politics. Republican lawmakers who have defended the president dismiss any impeachment move. But the Democratic House may be headed toward making Trump only the third U.S. president to be impeached, says legal analyst Paul Schiff Berman.
These are extraordinarily serious allegations. I'm not sure there's ever been a time in our history where we've had a president who has conducted foreign policy for his own personal political gain.
Impeachment in the House is only a first step, says William Galston.
If there are articles of impeachment voted in the House of Representatives, which in the U.S. system serves as the sort of the prosecutor making the case, but the real jury is the Senate of the United States, and there it would take a two-thirds majority to remove President Trump from office.
Republicans hold a majority in the Senate, and the president remains confident about what would happen if an impeachment trial took place.
And then we'll get it to the Senate, and we're going to win. The Republicans have been very unified. This is the greatest witch hunt in the history of our country.
Convicting the president and removing him from office would require a two-thirds vote in the Senate, or 67 of the 100 members. That would be a tall order for Democrats based on what we know now, says William Galston.
That would mean that 20 Republican senators out of 53 would have to join with the Democrats in order to carry out that act. And that requires a much broader coalition of support across party lines than we've seen so far.
The last impeachment trial in the Senate came in 1999, when President Bill Clinton was acquitted of the charges related to his affair with intern Monica Lewinsky. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, as the focus of the impeachment inquiry focuses on Trump urging the new leader of Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden, there are reports the president has also reached out to other foreign leaders for assistance in investigating and potentially discrediting the investigation into the Russian interference in the 2016 presidential campaign. One of those other leaders was the Prime Minister of Australia, where the Russia investigation apparently actually started with their intelligence gathering that led to talking to the FBI about it. One of those leaders joining us now is Dr. Charles Miller, lecturer of political science at the Australian National University. Tell us about all this.
It appears that he has actually agreed to this request and will allow this investigation into the investigation. This has caused quite a lot of controversy in Australia because we follow US news quite closely. We are aware how irregular many people perceive the investigation into the Mueller investigation to be. And so for an Australian Prime Minister to be assisting President Trump with a request of this type is pretty controversial.
It is an investigation that apparently is seeking to discredit the investigation that by all indications was done by very reputable people, but I'm still not quite clear on the Australia connection to the Russia investigation.
So the origins of the Russia investigation, many people believe the lies of the dossier that's collected by Christopher Steele, who is a former British intelligence officer. However, the origins of the FBI inquiry, as I understand, lie not with Steele, but rather with Alexander Downer. Now, Downer was the former Australian Foreign Secretary at the time of the Iraq War, so that is effectively the equivalent of Secretary of State. And he later became High Commissioner to London, which means basically the Australian ambassador in London. Now, he had a conversation with Papadopoulos, who's a member of the Trump team, and Papadopoulos at this conversation told him that the Trump team had some dirt on Hillary Clinton that they had obtained, and possibly by a Russian source. And so Downer was alerted by this to contact the American authorities. So bearing in mind, of course, that Trump had not been elected, Obama was still in power, so he contacted U.S. intelligence services and tipped them off that Papadopoulos had said this. And this was what launched the FBI inquiry into the Trump campaign's ties with by Russia. It was not the Steele dossier. It was this conversation which was had in London between a member of the Trump staff and Alexander Downer, who was effectively the Australian ambassador to London at the time. And he turned over this information to the US intelligence agencies, and that is what sparked the FBI inquiry. So that's why Australia is involved.
But why would the Trump administration think that that sort of information would discredit the Russia investigation? It sounds more like it sort of validates it.
It's a good question. I don't really know the answer to that. From what I understand from various sources, there are some conspiracy theories that have floated around about Alexander Downer, that he's some kind of deep state super spy. This is something that perhaps President Trump himself picked up on. So that's probably where it comes from. There is the alternative possibility, which is that because supporters of President Trump put so much effort into discrediting the Steele dossier, that now what they want to do is to go after this other origin, if you like, of the Mueller-Russia investigation. So what we can actually say is, well, look, you may or may not find the Steele dossier convincing, but that's not where the origins of the Mueller report lie. The origins of the Mueller report lie with this conversation which Downer had in London. And so perhaps the thinking for Trump loyalists is, if you can discredit that origin, then you have done a much more convincing job of discrediting the Mueller report. That is another possible interpretation, but that seems to suggest a greater deal of strategizing on the part of Trump's supporters than perhaps they're actually engaged in.
Overall, this whole drama, we've got television and social media, and the world is very connected. What are people there saying about what they are seeing here?
There are a small number of people in Australian politics who hold a candle for Donald Trump. Possibly our Prime Minister Scott Morrison is one of those people. And there are other people on certain parts of the Australian right, what you might call the populist right, who are quite favourable towards President Trump. But overall, Australians are pretty dismayed by what they've seen from the Trump administration, even those who are fairly conservative and centre-right in their political orientations. And in fact, Australia is now, Australians have generally begun to see the United States as a much more unreliable partner since Donald Trump became president. And in fact, even now, in certain circles, the conversation which many people are having is, how does Australia prepare for a post-American region, namely the Asia-Pacific, in which the United States is not as trustworthy, not as reliable, not as powerful as it once was. In fact, even some Australian influential commentators have even floated the idea of developing Australia's own nuclear deterrent. So we are actually talking about Australia, which has been a very, very solid American ally for a very long time, talking about a lot of people thinking that the United States can't really be relied on anymore. In elite political circles, most people still hold very tightly to the alliance, but the sands are starting to shift. And I think it's fair to say that Trump has done quite a lot of damage to this particular alliance, which the United States has. And I think that this is a pattern that we've seen with many other American allies too.
All right, that's Dr. Charles Miller, lecturer of political science at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. puts visa restrictions on Chinese officials over the treatment of Muslims. Studies find high incidences of abuse of mothers during childbirth. Al-Qaeda's South Asia chief has been killed in Afghanistan in a raid. And research finds dog owners are more likely to survive a heart attack or a stroke. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Tanzania's President John Magufuli is known as the bulldozer for refusing to tolerate criticism of himself and his policies since coming into office in 2015. Critics say Magufuli's government has squeezed press freedoms through harsh media laws and intimidation. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Tanzanian authorities arrested TV journalist Joseph Gandia in August for publishing false information after he broadcast a story alleging police abuse of detainees. Gandia was held for 3 days, then released on bail. He stands by his report and says the charges are political motivated. Gandhi says, we want to try to report an issue which has the truth and involves authorities. Sometimes a journalist, you will end up arrested. You'll end up being told that you have written a false story, even if the story is true. Gandhi's arrest came a month after police charged reporter Eric Kabendera with tax evasion, money laundering, and organized crime. Kabendera denies the charges and says they are connected to his critical reports of the Magufuli government. Rights Group says the arrests are part of a pattern in which Magufuli uses new media laws in order to silence critics. Anna Henger is the executive director for Legal and Human Rights Center.
So how would I recommend amendment of these rules? Because even the Universal Periodic Review of the United Nations recommended that these laws should be amended. They should remove the restrictions which are put by those laws.
Under Magufuli, Tanzania enacted strict laws on cyber crimes and media services. The laws allow authorities to suspend media outlets and charge journalists with sedition for publishing information deemed a threat to peace, false, or even just misleading. Tanzania's authorities deny cracking down on freedom of the press and argue the laws are needed to prevent media abuse. Harrison Mwakembe is the Minister of Information. He says, "We insist there is press freedom. Myself, I'm a journalist. I am deeply concerned with media houses. I will not allow limiting press freedoms. No. For a journalist, you report your story, criticize the government, but for the purpose of building the country." Media groups say the laws are encouraging self-censorship and fueling fears among Tanzania's journalists that they are target. Salome Kitomari is the chairperson for Media Institute of Southern Africa. She says, "We have the case that's happened 2 years ago, our colleague Azory Gwanda. Until now, we don't know about his whereabouts. This is something scary in journalism." Meanwhile, Tanzania's journalists do what they can in an increasingly risky profession. For Gandhi, that means waiting for his day in court. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a moment.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Plastics Oceans International, a nonprofit organization which often uses film to inspire, inform, and get people engaged in its mission to end plastic pollution, has a new project and a new kids' film, a 20-minute educational tool that hopes to inspire young people to be part of the solution. Joining us to talk more about the film is Julie Anderson, Global Executive Director for Plastic Oceans International. We know it's a crisis now, and certainly there are continuing to be more human beings and more plastic being used, not less. So obviously something needs to be done. I understand that you have a new educational children's film that is created to enlighten children, obviously the future of this planet, on how to solve this problem.
Exactly. And then, as you mentioned, we know that plastic is a global crisis and there is not one solution. This is going to take a whole rethink, a conscious shift in how we think about what we use, our waste, and it's going to have to start from all ages. And we created this film to educate audiences that are 5 to 10 years old, so a really young audience, on the human impact on the environment. So everything we use, plastic especially, goes somewhere. And so it's really informing young audiences that they have an impact and that they need to think about that impact. And so the takeaway message is refuse the items you don't need, reuse items so that you create less waste, and if you have to use it, make sure that it's recycled.
Right, and of course, we know children are the future. We know that when something is instilled in them at a very young age, they can definitely see the problem and they get to work fixing it. We've seen seen that all over the world with the recent climate protests of all the young people that are really concerned about their future and they're taking action. So tell us a little bit about specifics about this film. Tell us about how it was created and what, you know, how it goes about creating the message that's relatable to children.
So the film is called Earth's Echo, and that's Earth possessive and Echo, E-K-K-O. Echo is an animated character, a living creature living in for millions of years at the bottom of the ocean, and he's lived there peacefully, maintaining the balance of the ecosystem there, but his environment's being affected. And he's coming up to the surface, meeting three human friends to find out what the problem is, plastic pollution, but more importantly, how it can be solved. What are some of the solutions to plastic pollution? And the three humans go on this adventure, learning about plastic, but how to be part of the solution. And the way that this came about, the film came about because we noticed a lot of the messaging around plastic pollution and other environmental issues tends to be very heavy and be a little bit negative because it shows all the dying animals and the polluted nature. And even though that is true, but for young audiences, 5 to 10 years old, this can be a very heavy, depressing way to inform them of the problem. And so we wanted to take a more positive approach, saying, you know, the world is beautiful. Yes, there is a problem, but there are solutions. We just have to be creative in how we think about them.
Have you tried it out on any children yet?
We've shown this film to probably a little over 200 students around the country. They've all reacted quite favorably. It's an easy message, and it's part of the call to action is to refuse, reuse, recycle. And also, there's a website, earthsecho.com, that allows students to submit their ideas for being part of the solution. So we've received dozens and dozens of videos and emails saying, this is how I recycle, this is how I reuse plastic, this is how I inform my families and their schools. So it's been incredible to see the number of proactive and active steps that these young students are taking.
And are these going to be distributed throughout schools or to the general public, or how does it work?
It's going to be distributed to the general public. You can watch it for free at earthsecho.com. So it's earth and E-K-K-O.com. And it's for free to watch on there. We're reaching out to schools directly so that they can utilize it there. If they can't watch it through YouTube, they can also reach out to plasticoceans.org to contact us, and we can send them a direct download. We're also translating it currently into Spanish, French, and Portuguese, and we hope to have another 6 languages before the end of the year so that we can have a real global distribution of the film, and we're going to be providing it for free.
So it goes beyond just telling them what the problem is. It goes to look at some ways you can resolve it.
Exactly, and the idea is to really empower and then engage them so that they know that there is no one solution. It's going to vary from city to city around the globe what they do, but showing that by thinking about their impact and how they are using the plastic and how it's being managed, getting them engaged on that level is that step into rethinking plastic and reducing the amount of plastic pollution.
All right. That is Julie Anderson. She is the Global Executive Director for Plastic Oceans International. We thank you so much for being with us. Well, the Eagles, a 70s American classic rock band that continues to sell out concert venues, has announced plans for massive performances of their album Hotel California during a 2020 tour. Performances of the 1976 album will include a 46-piece orchestra and a 22-voice choir. Organizers announced Tuesday that in total, 77 musicians are expected to be on stage when the Eagles perform hits from the album, including New Kid in Town and Life in the Fast Lane. The band's tour kicks off in February in Atlanta, Georgia, and will end in April in Los Angeles, California, with stops including New York, Dallas, and many others. The band recently performed the album in its entirety at shows in Las Vegas, the first time in its history that it played the whole album in concert. The new kid in town. Everybody loves you. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.